Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Larry Stouffer, who is the director of the Screenwriting Conference in Santa Fe. And we're also going to be having some young people from the upcoming Rocky Horror Show, ladies and gentlemen, speaking and singing and carrying on the Radio Cafe today. Right now, I would like to welcome Greg Serrano. He's an actor who's a cast member of the ABC series Wildfire, and he recently opened a new black box theater in Albuquerque called The Studio, an Actor's Space. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary. Good morning.
Good morning. Now, you're a film actor. You've done a lot of work in Los Angeles, film and television. Why did you relocate to New Mexico? Is it just because of Wildfire?
Yes. I was cast in L.A. Hi. This is so cool. First of all, let me just say to everyone, the format here is just really cool. We're actually live in the cafe. And,
we are indeed.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting. So I was cast in L.A. That's a little bit of an interesting story. We can get back to that if you like. But cast out of L.A., shot the pilot in Old Town, and thought that all of New Mexico was like Old Town Albuquerque. So just a plaza and like one hotel and one restaurant. But when the series was picked up and we moved out, we saw the rest of the city and then the surrounding cities and then most of the state. We just fell in love. So, yes, the show brought us here and New Mexico made us stay here.
And so you are not only doing film and TV, but you are doing this black box studio. First of all, what is, for our listeners, a black box theater?
So a black box theater is just that. It's a black box.
It's a big black
room.
It's a
big black square room. And the idea behind it is the color black. It's supposed to be nothing and everything. It can be anything that you want it to be. So for an actor to come into a space of emptiness and create in their mind a scene or a place.
Now, does that mean you don't use scenery and sets?
Correct. There are no props, no sets. It can be anything can be placed in there. You can put sets in and use props and all that. But no, for all intents and purposes, for me, it's used as an audition workshop.
When you say an audition workshop, what do you mean?
I mean that it's a space for actors to come in and work primarily on auditions. Auditions are the most difficult part of the whole process of casting a role or anything involved with an actor creating, getting a job as in a film or a TV show. The initial audition is the hardest because you don't have the job yet. There's all that anticipation involved. You don't have an idea of the character or what's going on necessarily in the whole script. You only just normally get like one scene out of the script. So it's very, a nervous time for an actor. So.
And you're competing against Lord knows how many people.
Yes, many people for only one opening, and you have to be great. So the audition is different, going back to what you said about there being no sets, there being no props. Well, it's much easier when you're on a set and there's everything there and you're with actors and you have props and there's lights and when you have to perform a scene that might entail all that stuff, but there's nothing there. You're just sitting in a chair or standing in front of someone else who's reading from a page like this. They're talking to you and they're reading their words. So you have to still invoke all these feelings and things from the audience, you know?
And you have to pull it out of nowhere, out of your imagination, or out of thin air.
Exactly. You have to you have to create it for yourself. You have to see it all happening. It has to be real for you. And for me, if you're in that space of realness, in the space of realness, then you can really, really do well.
How did you become an actor in the first place? You were a guy from Brooklyn who wanted to be a fireman.
I'm from Brooklyn, yo! Yes, I'm born and raised in Brooklyn. Lived there for most of my young life until I was 24. Yeah, I was set on being a cop or a firefighter. I went to the 13th grade, which was basically an extension of high school, local community college. And my best friend at the time was in a play. And he said, hey, Greg, why don't you, you know, come hang out with me, work backstage, basically to do that, just to hang out. And I did, and there was an actor in the play that he was in that I thought resembled me physically. And I thought he sucked. So I would remember his, I would listen to his lines backstage, and then I would say them how I thought he should be saying them. And so the next play came around, and I auditioned.
I thought you were going to say you just walked in and replaced him.
I was wishing I would, because he was really terrible. But no, so I auditioned against him, really just strictly out of pride, and I got the role. And then from that, I was nominated for an Irene Ryan Award, which is like a collegiate theatrical competition. And so I went to this thing at Penn State and made it to the finals, my first go out. And they call it being bit by the bug, and I was. And I got back and auditioned for the next play and got that. And then went into the city and started working at NYU and with some of the actors there and some of their off Broadway productions.
That's a lot of offs.
No, just for experience. And I saw a show on E! Television Network, and it was titled How to Make It in Hollywood. And it was all palm trees and Hollywood and glitz and glamour, and I recorded it on my VHS and watched it, and said to my friend Aaron that was in the play, I said, let's go to LA. And he's like, at this point it was a year later, he wanted to be a magician at this time, so he's like, yeah, I want to go to LA. And I'm like, yeah, I want to go to LA. So we bought a 1971 Buick convertible with bullet holes in it, and the top didn't work, and for $500. And I had maybe $800 in my pocket, and he had maybe $1,000. And we just left. Within like 2 weeks, we decided we were going to go, and we went. And
of our friends. That's amazing to watch a TV how-to show and actually listen, actually follow the instructions, and now you're...
Well, you see, that was once you got there. So we didn't know. No, it wasn't like, you know, how to get there.
It didn't
tell
you about the Buick.
Right. It didn't say, like, it was like, once you're here, this is how you do it. So we didn't know how we were going to get there. And all our friends were like, whatever, we'll see you in a week. Yeah, when you break down, call us up. So we were like, no, we're really doing it. So we did it, and we got to L.A., and fortunately for us, being from Brooklyn, we knew what inner city was like. So... We broke down in on Hollywood Boulevard, Hollywood and Vine. Those of you who have been there, you know, it's like, it's the Walk of Fame, but transvestites and hookers and crackheads. And it was great. It was great and terrible all at the same time. So we broke down and we're like, wow, we're in the middle of Hollywood at this point from the trip. You know, with gas and food and hotels, I maybe had $600 and... Wow, what are we going to do? And we just found an apartment like the next day in this part of the city that we really didn't want to live in, and just got started. So I got the usual job that actors have, which is waiting tables. That's like they say, you're an actor, really, what restaurant do you work at? You know, that's the running joke. And so I did that, and but I was in Hollywood, so I was working at this... Very much like this, like a cafe, coffee shop. And one of my first actors that walked in was Nick Turturro from NYPD Blue. And me from New York. So he walks in, I'm like, Nick Turturro, oh my God, look. And he's like, yeah, give me my coffee, dude. Just so that was interesting. And so I lost my accent right away. I knew that I couldn't be taken seriously if I, you know, said water and coffee. And so I sat in my little studio apartment and worked on losing my, you know, my Brooklyn accent, and audition, you know, found an agent and just this little teeny little boutique agency. And I'm half Italian and I'm half black. But I guess that makes Latin, because that's what I look.
That
makes me Puerto Rican. Or Cuban, or in LA I was Mexican, whatever. So, but no, I look Latin, and, I didn't, you know, growing up in Brooklyn, all my friends were Irish and Italian, and A few Puerto Ricans, but never like a city like that. For me, I didn't get the whole segregation thing. Everything was it was for me a melting pot, and you know, everyone was, it didn't matter what nationality you were. And
in New York,
yeah. And then for me to be like labeled like Latin, I was like, I'm not Latin, you know, I'm American, you know.
Right.
But anyway, so I get this first audition, and it's for this gangbanger role in The Rich Man's Wife with Halle Berry, and there are no like cholos in Brooklyn, at least for me there weren't, right? But in LA, that's huge. So this neighborhood we lived in, there were a lot of cholos, and they wear their, you know, really like super like baggy pants and like pin. So like I like picked up the accent and then like went in for the thing and then like got the job, you know. So that's my first job.
Being able to do accents is a really big part of the craft.
Yeah, because so much of it is like, that's how you tell like characters. Like Brooklyn is huge. Like you'll see a lot of characters. Boston, where my publicist Dawn Singh, she's awesome, is from. But those kind of accents that really, you know, kind of determine places around the country. So yeah, to do accents is pretty cool. So I picked it up really quick.
And meanwhile, I mean, you have, I find it so interesting with actors. The craft of acting is it's a very involved set of techniques and practices, but you also had a gift that you just found backstage when you were delivering somebody else's lines at the age of 17 or whatever. How did you learn your craft? I mean, were you taking acting lessons in LA?
Well, it's funny that you say that. I just said this to Dawn this morning. Ignorance is bliss for me. And to not know that I don't know something. I think that many actors make the mistake of thinking that there's too much involved in it. And that's why acting with quotes around it makes you tell when someone is acting. Because they feel like they have to do something other than just be real. Because that's, for me, that's what acting is. It's just being...
Being real, but somebody else.
No way. It's not even, no. It's actually, for me, it's being me in that situation. So it's like, what would it be like if me, Greg, were born in, you know, Guatemala and not Brooklyn? What would that have been like? What would that entail? So it's not like being this other person, it's like me in this other situation.
Interesting.
And that's kind of what I want to impress on actors in that take my class, is like, don't think of it as becoming somebody else. Think of it as you just in this other situation.
So you're teaching classes essentially for people in Albuquerque, essentially for people who want to become a part of New Mexico's burgeoning film industry?
Burgeoning is a great word. I mean, it's just becoming at a really quick pace. It's before you know it, it's going to be everywhere. So I don't teach. I call myself a coach. And I offer, I've been at this for going on 14 years. As a grinding actor initially, but as a working actor consistently for 13 years. So
now, my understanding of the New Mexico film industry is that people come in from outside, usually California, sometimes other places. They take advantage of the New Mexico film incentives. Then they hire local set dressers, electricians, carpenters, and so on. But they bring their actors, their directors, and so on. Do you see that changing, or are you part of the push to change that? In other words, so that actors and directors are homegrown New Mexicans?
Well, I know that the state, I know that the governor has just put together this in-state teaching program for producers and directors to raise producers and directors in-state. I know that that's happening now.
Yeah, there's a program at the College of Santa Fe.
Okay, yeah, and I know that's going to be expanded. We just spoke maybe a couple weeks ago, and that's really going to be a big part of it. So yeah, so production companies come into the state. State offers an incentive program, rebates, you know, very low interest loans, things of that nature, and they come in to take advantage of that. They don't, and then when they hire locals, crew members, like you said, set dressers, makeup artists, then they get back 25%. of whatever they pay them, which is incredible for the production company.
Right.
Which is the same true for actors. So they, so if they hire a local actor, not only do they get the rebate, but they don't have to pay for their airfare, which is always last minute. So you're talking, you know, $1,000 to fly from LA, last minute. Hotel, you got to stay in a four-star or a high-class hotel. Per diem, which means they have to get paid, I think it's $65 or $70 per day, just spending money, cash money. All that they get to save on top of getting the money back. So,
right.
So production companies, I believe, really want to hire as many locals as possible. However, like with all of the industries, all of the different, what do you call them, areas, they need expertise in. So the makeup artist, they can't just hire someone who's does makeup on their sister, you know?
Right.
And the same true for actors. It's like, yeah, I know you want to be an actor, but there's a lot riding on this. So my job is to make actors, first and foremost, understand that it's a business, that it's not just, you know, well, here, let me come in, I want to be an actor, and I'm going to do it. There's a lot riding on it. Actors get paid a lot of money to do what they do. And once you understand that, then you have to understand that your level of professionalism has to be really high if you're thinking about working as a speaking actor.
We're talking to Greg Serrano. Let's talk about Eric Bogosian's play, which is, I guess, already running at your Black Box Theater. Is that mm-hmm. right?
Yep. So I've transformed the space. Initially, for a year, it was just an acting workshop. An actor's studio to come in for actor's work. And then I met a local actor, David Garver, on the set of Wildfire. He was a guest star for a few episodes. And met him, stayed in contact with him, and he said, hey, I have this show that I've been doing, and it's called Wake Up and Smell the Coffee by Eric Bogosian, and I'd love for you to see it. And I said, why don't we just put it up? Why don't we just let everyone else see it as well? So I transformed the space into a mini theater that seats about 35 right now. And Wake Up is performed by David.
It's a one-man show.
Mm-hmm. About 14 characters.
Tell us what Eric Bogosian's work is like.
You know, I'm not that familiar with his stuff. Edgy.
He takes on different characters.
Yeah, well, so Eric Bogosian is the playwright. So Eric, I guess, wrote this just after 9/11, and I guess it's mostly about what's really important. And the play touches a lot on the fact that we, as Americans, mostly, the fascination with celebrity, the desire for a need for or belief of need for money. He wrote like 14 characters, and they all, in one form or another, are dealing with, you know, one of those issues. He plays Satan in one of them, and, you know, talks about, hey, you know, what you want is money. You know, you want money, you know, and it's just, it's funny. It's really, it's an in-your-face kind of look at yourself. Everyone gets to see a mirror image of really what they're thinking, definitely in one of the characters.
And it's quite a workout for the actor.
Yeah, it's an hour and a half, broken up into two 45-minute segments. Ton of dialogue to remember for one person. David is just a phenomenal actor, though, and again, without even seeing the play, I took it on. And transform the space. So now it's up and running. We had our first run May 2nd and 3rd. Two nights, sold out performances. We're going to run again next weekend, which is the
23rd and
24th. So two shows on Friday, one show on Saturday. Great. It's a great show because it's a taste of, like, New York theater. It's a taste of, like, real, just real theater.
I know. I was thinking about I was familiar with Bogosian's work when I used to live back east in Boston, and I was thinking of how, in a way, New Mexico's film industry has, or even not the theater, not so much maybe, but there's a tendency to do Western stuff or regional stuff or Southwestern stuff, which is great because this is where we are. But Boghossian is such a whole different feeling. And for those of us who are Eastern transplants, it's kind of like going home for a few minutes.
Right, exactly. That's true. And I never thought of it that way. Maybe that's why I relate to it. But for some reason, the audience, you know, both nights, again, just a great range of ages and types and backgrounds. They all just loved it.
Now, if people would like to go or to be in contact with you, how do they do that?
Yes, let me get you the number. Actually, I don't have it on me, so what I'll have to do is
Dawn's
dig
number?
That up. No, it's going to be Heather, and the number is 505-670-5113. 505-670-5113.
And that way they can find out about both the studio and actor space and more about your own
Yes,
work.
The website's still being built, but the website is anactorsspace@thestudios.biz. So it's anactors...
They can just Google it.
Space, yeah, @thestudios.biz. And that's still being built. But yes, find out information. Tickets are $15 in advance, $18 at the door. They can be purchased over the phone. So anybody who hasn't seen theater at all should definitely, if you're going to, this would probably be one of the best ones to start with. And anyone who's in the industry should definitely check it out because it's a different look at it. I think it's a really it's a great show. People leave like, wow, like I was really entertained.
Greg Serrano is an actor, cast member of the ABC series Wildfire.
ABC Family.
Family series, right. And his Black Box Theater in Albuquerque is called The Studio and Actor Space. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, man.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. More about film coming right up. I'd like now to welcome Larry Stoffer. He is the founder and executive director of the Screenwriting Conference in Santa Fe, which is from May 27th to June 1st at the Lodge in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. Happy to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
And thanks for inviting us to come here and talk about the conference.
Well, the Screenwriting Conference is, as you say, designed to teach the art and craft of writing a screenplay that is saleable in Hollywood. Why Hollywood? Why not independent films of all kinds, including but not limited to Hollywood?
It's not exclusive. The idea of writing a screenplay that's saleable to Hollywood means that that you follow the craft. Screenwriting is a craft. It's not like a novel or a short story or something where you have unlimited pages and you can just do anything you want to do. Screenwriting is a craft, and if you write the screenplay and honor the craft just as though it were a Hollywood project, then it fits anything.
So if Hollywood, I mean, when I watch Hollywood movies, and I watch movies on video, I sometimes go to the theater, I prefer independent films and foreign films a lot of the time because the Hollywood movies seem to have such a formula. Now, you have to write to that formula. I suppose you have to teach that formula, and yet the formula so often shows.
It's, again, it goes to the craft. I mean, telling stories on film it goes back a long ways, and so what has happened is that through the years, people have analyzed the successful movies and have discovered that there are certain elements and certain progressions, like structure and so forth, that work, that audiences like, you know, that are appealing and satisfying. And so you see a lot of that in Hollywood. Now, if you can depart from that. You see a lot of films that do depart from that, but what you don't see, Mary Charlotte, are all those that departed from it that didn't work. You know, so there's a rare here and there, you know, rare films that pop up that do defy the craft, but if you study them carefully, you'll realize that they've disguised it. It's still there. I mean, just consider this. If you tell a joke or you tell a story, there's a beginning, there's a middle, and an end. The motion picture industry thrives on the three-act structure. That's what we, you know, so it's the same thing. The first act is the setup. The second act is the confrontation. And the third act is the resolution. So it's just basic common storytelling that goes back thousands of years.
So what are the, when you say the elements, is that what you're talking about, the three-act structure, or are there other things that also are crucial elements to writing a successful screenplay?
There are. Now, the three-act structure is the fundamental part of writing a screenplay. And then when you go deeper than that, then there are certain, we could call them tricks of the trade if we want to, you know, but it's developing characters, and it's that's one thing that you is part of what you're talking about. Another thing is setting things up so that pay off later in the story. That's another thing. There are hundreds of things. As a matter of fact, at our conference, we break that down because we have classes that you can take that are 8-9 hour classes, and then in the afternoons we go into hour and a half seminars. Now each of those seminars speaks to what you just got through saying. You can take one on formatting, you can take one on subtext, you can take one on character development, you can take, you know, all these different things that we do that you're just talking about, to touch on stuff that maybe you might want to touch up on or something that you might want to learn. And I need to get more experience. I don't quite understand what subtext is. I don't understand, you know, how to set things up for later. You know, there are a lot of things. So each thing helps you to perfect. All right, lose that word. There's no such thing. But anyway, to get as close to perfection as possible.
So does Hollywood buy character-driven plots at this point?
There is a sort of known that Hollywood tends to go to story-driven. New York tends to go to character-driven. There's been this age-old argument about which is more important, character-driven or story-driven.
You know, the ancient Greeks will tell you character.
Well, Aristotle, you know, goes there, and he talks more about story, where Lahus Igre talks about character. So those two guys are, you know, differed. But the reality is, and this is something I've studied for a long time, no one is more important than the other.
Well, and are they not completely intertwined? I mean, does story not spring from character?
And vice versa, yeah. I mean, if you don't have a well-developed or have well-developed characters, then nobody will really care. I mean, if you go see a movie and you don't care who the you know, about the hero, who he or she is and what they're doing, then it doesn't make any difference how many car wrecks and airplane explosions and whatever else that you want to talk about happens in the story. You couldn't care less. So that means that characters are extremely important. The flip side of that is if you have a character that you're interested in at the beginning, and nothing really interesting happens in the story, I don't have to finish that
sentence. You need
so
a plot.
It's a balance. It's just balance, like anything else in life.
We're talking to Larry Stouffer of the Screenwriting Conference in Santa Fe. So what are the role models? Let's say you feel that you have a story inside of you and you want to tell it through screenwriting, you want to write a screenplay. What are the role models that perhaps beginning screenwriters should look at? Literature, Anna Karenina, Greek tragedy, other screenplays?
All the above. All that stuff informs you in terms of your ability to tell story. So I don't think that there's anything that would be considered off limits. Certainly, we go back to craft again. Now, if you're talking about writing a screenplay, just remember that a screenplay is a story told in pictures. Some of the challenges that people run into when we do adaptations, novels tend to be, to a great extent, introspective, because, you know, we can read what the character's thinking. On the screen, you can't.
Right.
Okay, so what we have to do then, and we do have as a matter of fact, at the conference, we do have one of our seminars is on adaptation. But the thing is that when you adapt, you know, you never see it said that this movie is a faithful replication of the book. It's always based on, if you'll notice. Okay, so that's the reason for that. So some people say, well,
there's so many more scenes in most novels than you could fit into a hour and a half movie.
Well, you're right. That's the other thing. I mean, if you're writing a novel, you could write, it could be 1,000 pages. It could be 2,000. Whatever.
But even if it's normal length, it's going to have more scenes than a movie.
That's right, exactly. So, but in a screenplay, we're limited to a maximum of 120 pages.
Which is 2 hours.
Which is 2 hours, exactly. So, in fact, Hollywood wants more like 110, and for certain genres, you want less than 100. You know, so those were, so you were already painted into a corner.
Right.
Forget Anna Karenina. I mean, we just couldn't possibly pull that off, you know, very easily in 110 pages and be able to capture all of the book. You just can't do that.
Right.
Sometimes in adaptations, she'll take several characters in a book and combine them into one to do that.
So when you teach screenwriting, you must also teach what to do once you've actually written a screenplay, where to go from there.
Well, where to go from there. The conference, the screenwriting conference in Santa Fe, which, as you know, this is our 10th year, this is our 10th one, is divided into two components. And one is the screenwriting symposium, which you had mentioned at the outset, that where we set about to teach the art and craft of writing a screenplay that's saleable to Hollywood. The other component that starts after the screenwriting symposium starts on Tuesday and goes through Saturday at noon. Then after Saturday at lunch, then we convene the Hollywood Connection. That's where we speak to the business aspects of screenwriting. So in the first part, we bring in Hollywood writers and people who are teaching the craft, primarily, of screenwriting. The second component, the Hollywood Connection, speaks to the business aspects, and we bring in Hollywood producers who are aggressively looking for screenplays. And so they come in here, they do panel discussions, and we talk about what they're looking for, and then all of our writers have opportunities to what's called pitching to them. And we set up private 5-minute pitches with producers, so you can go in and pitch your screenplay to a producer if you feel like it, it's appropriate for that particular producer or the company, really, that that producer represents.
There was that great and sort of cynical movie called The Player, which starts out with people pitching their scripts in Hollywood, and it's sort of like, and this script is, you know, Casablanca meets Roots, or, you know,
yeah.
I mean, sort of ridiculous. There was this is a combination of this and this.
Right.
I mean, pitching is salesmanship to the point where one wonders whether somebody with a kind of deep and modest character could ever get their script produced.
Someone with deep and modest.
Yeah, somebody who's not about selling themselves.
Oh, well, we have one of our seminars at the conference is called The Art of the 5-Minute Pitch. And so it speaks exactly to what you're saying. And so it's a craft, again. The pitch is a craft. And, you know, sometimes they're called elevator pitches. You know, you get on an elevator and all the doors close and all of a sudden there's Steven Spielberg standing next to you. Oh, my God, you know, what am I going to do? And one of the things that we run into when we pitch as beginning writers or beginning pitchers, I guess you could say, is that we get so carried away in what is happening in our story. That we forget that what the producer doesn't care what happens in the story. They couldn't care less about how many love scenes you have or how many car crashes or any of that stuff. They don't want to know what happens in your story. That's the key thing. They want to know what it's about. Now, when you internalize that concept, then what you do is you learn that the art of the 5-minute pitch goes to what's called a log line. And the log line is a term that is picked up from when you pick up TV Guide and you look through it and you see what's showing tonight. Those are log lines. And so the key thing in a pitch is that you can perfect your log line. So in one or two sentences maximum, you need to be able to tell the producer what your story is about. And it goes to title, it goes to genre, it goes to the character, your hero. It goes to what their confrontations are going to be, and maybe you might want to talk a little bit about the resolution, but you want to leave that hanging a little bit, because when I talk to people about going in to do pitches, I say what you're really after when you're talking to that producer is you want her to say the four magic words, send it to me. Then you get the hell out of there, because you don't want to stand there long enough to talk them out of it. And so that's key. So that's the object, is to be able to get a producer interested in your story enough to say, I want to read that. So, send that to me.
Now, is the screenwriting conference also applicable for people who are making documentaries, or is it more just about feature films?
More about feature films. It's the narrative thing. And although we do touch on television, it only goes, we don't touch on documentaries really much at all, except that even in a documentary, there's a beginning, a middle, and an end. And so some of the tricks that we use, the techniques that we use in screenwriting are indeed applicable to documentaries. But as far as TV is concerned, and I know you didn't ask about that, but we don't really speak too much to television other than long form. Movies of the week, movies for cable, and
made for TV movies are no different in terms of screenwriting than made for theater movies.
Not really. They're not. I mean, it's still the beginning, middle, and end. And for years, I've pondered what is the difference between a movie that's written for TV and a movie that's written for, you know, for theatrical. And typically, a television movie is written so that the budget is low. You know, you don't, and it's a character-driven thing more, as you were mentioning earlier about character-driven. I think TV movies typically are more character-driven, you know, because it's a small screen. So it's more dialogue rather than more action. That's one thing.
So people actually do, in that sense, do write differently for TV than for movies because of the size of the screen?
Yeah. I think that has an awful lot to do with it because you can't, you know, the big widescreen movies, I mean, you know, don't fit necessarily on the small screen.
Right, and if you rent rent a DVD and then put the widescreen on, you're watching this little, you know, spaghetti width band across your TV set, and it's hard to see.
Well,
unless you've got a huge screen.
You press your nose up against the screen so
that's
you
right.
can see everything.
It's good for the TV and your nose.
Yeah.
We're talking to Larry Stouffer. So what does it take to, how many of the screenplays that are sold actually get made? I mean, you go through this whole process. They say, send it to me. You know, the great moment comes. They buy it. Then do they always make it?
When you meet someone that either tells you that he or she is a screenwriter, or you find out that they're a screenwriter, you know automatically they're a lunatic. See, because there's no rhyme or reason.
Are you including yourself?
Absolutely. You know, I'm leading the band on that deal. Because see, what happens is that the formula is this: that when you write a screenplay, when you finish it, although there's no such thing as that, but when you get it to where you can present it, you think, the first thing you do is you send it out to L.A. or New York to the Writers Guild and register it so that you have some copyright protection, you know. Okay, then Hollywood, the Writers Guild in L.A. and in New York, they're the two offices. It's arguably around 20 to 30,000 screenplays are registered with the Writers Guild every year. Now then, Hollywood buys about 1,000 screenplays, and they produce about 400 movies. So you do the math.
Yeah.
I mean, it's you might as well go to Las Vegas and start throwing dice because, I mean, and it's you spend a year writing a screenplay. Your heart and your soul is wrapped up in it. And the odds are so far against you. So the way to improve those odds is one of the reasons, if not the reason, that the screenwriting conference in Santa Fe was created. So that
I
we
mean,
could all learn.
Here's what blows my mind. Most of the movies Hollywood produces are crap. So are they rejecting the good stuff, or is the stuff they're rejecting even worse crap than what they produce?
Well, I know it's—I don't know that the word "most" is, you know, is the operative word, but I agree with you that that we all kind of wonder how did that thing ever get made, you know? And I think a lot of it has to do with politics. It has to do with—I mean, it's a business. It's called the motion picture business. And when I teach screenwriting, that's the first thing I write on the blackboard, motion picture business, because I tell everybody this word business will inform a lot of the things that you do. Now, if you're not interested in craft and you're not interested in the business, then for heaven's sake, get away from this. Go write novels and short stories and live happily ever after. Don't put yourself through what we do. But if you have a passion for writing for the screen, and passion is the key word.
I know, but you're not answering my question.
Well, I am answering it because I'm telling you it's a business. And so what happens is that if Hollywood, let's call it, it's a general term, it's the same thing is true for independent films, feels like that they have something that will capture the imagination of the ticket-buying public, it's a business. They're going to do it. They are not interested in the art. They're only interested in the business. So that's one thing we have to
keep
in perspective.
And so they'll make conservative decisions and not take a risk on something that might have more art to it. If they don't think it's going to sell,
well, yeah,
tickets
I mean,
and popcorn.
That's the business, you know. And the same thing, if you'll notice, goes to casting. You know, they'll put people in roles, and you say, "Why is she in that role?"
Yeah, or Julia Roberts.
Well, you know, and so you say, "Well, Well, the reason is because it's the motion picture business.
Right. So it's just about time to go, but what, I mean...
I don't want to go.
Well, you have to go I've got somebody else on after you. But, I mean, the thing is, you walk around a coffee shop like this one in Santa Fe and you know, every third person is writing a screenplay. Most of them aren't even going to get in the door. Certainly most of them aren't going to be produced. What is it, what is that magic that it takes for somebody to actually be successful? I mean, is it something that can be learned? Is it really a gift, like acting, that some people have and some just don't?
I don't know about, when you use the term magic, I'm going to tell you that, you know, it goes to a miracle. And anytime a movie's made, it's a miracle, just for openers. But the key thing in any industry is being the best that you can possibly be at what you do. Therefore, the screenwriting conference is also, you know, an avenue for that, so we can be the best screenwriters that we can possibly be. And when you write a great screenplay, or what you feel like is, or really close to that, then you're a step, one step closer to Oz, if you will. You know, you're on your way down the yellow brick road, but you have to have a great screenplay to begin with, and then the rest of it goes to connections. You know, I mean, you can have contacts, or you can make contact in this coffee shop, but making connections is something else altogether, and that's one of the things that happens at the conference because of it, of its intimacy. It's not a cast of thousands that we have here, and thousands of people that come. And so you really get an opportunity to meet the Hollywood people and really get to know them and talk to them on a first name basis, and have your opportunity, you know, to maybe go down the yellow brick road and obviously get to Oz.
Larry Stouffer is the founder and executive director of the Screenwriting Conference in Santa Fe, which takes place May 27th to June 1st at the Lodge in Santa Fe. People can find out more information at SCSFE. As in Screenwriting Conference Santa Fe.com, SCSFE.com. And is there a telephone number that people can call?
Yeah, 424-1501.
Larry Stouffer, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. We appreciate it.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR.
It's astounding. Time is fleeting. Madness takes its toll. But listen closely.
Not for very much longer.
I've got to keep control.
Just a jump to the left.
And then a step to the right.
With your hands on your hips.
You bring your knees in tight. There is the velvet dust. It really does feel insane. Let's do the time warp again. Let's do the time warp again.
It's a dream. You can't see me. No, not at all. In another dimension, with voyeuristic intention. Well secluded, I see all.
With a bit of a mind flip,
you're into the time slip.
And in the background, the time warp from the Rocky Horror Show, which is going to be presented this coming weekend by the El Dorado Teen Players. Joining us right now are Laurel Wilson, J.D. Bray-Morris, and Asia Felsen. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi. Hi.
Now, the Rocky Horror Show, which probably many people know from the movie, the Rocky Horror Picture Show, was presented in London in the 70s. Is that correct?
Yes.
And so it was adapted to screen, and you're doing, is it the same as the original theater production?
Mm. It is.
So tell us the story. I mean, it's such as it is.
Why don't you do it, Asia?
Okay, well, it's about this couple that their car breaks down and they walk into this castle and it's filled with aliens and, yeah.
Well, they don't know they're aliens.
Yeah.
It's just weird people.
And so it's kind of a send-up of science fiction and monster movies, including Frankenstein. Mm. So who's the Frankenstein-like character?
That'd be Rocky. He's the creation.
Is that you?
Yeah, it's me.
So you play Rocky, and it's sort of like, it's sort of monster movie, and it's sort of also like cross-dressing wildness.
Yeah, pretty much. And 50s rock and roll.
And 50s rock and roll. So are you all doing the singing as well as the acting?
Yes. Yeah.
How did you, were you the ones who chose this show?
Yeah, they presented us with a choice of two shows, and everybody unanimously voted for Rocky Horror instead of the other show.
What's so appealing about it?
It's crazy and different, and you get to cross-dress and sing great music. And
it's a fun experience.
Yeah, a blast.
Now, in the movie version of it, in the 70s and 80s, people used to dress up as the characters and come in and sing and holler and throw things. Are you encouraging that from your audiences?
From what I understand, we're not really encouraging it, but not discouraging it. So if people like know what to say, we're going to let them say it, but we're not going to say anything. That's what I think.
Laura, what's your character?
I'm Janet Weiss.
And what is she all about?
Well, she's a very straight-laced girl, very 50s raised, you know, get married, have kids, the whole thing. And then it's kind of, she changes, she goes to this castle and she gets de-virginized, and it's very a big deal because, you know, she suddenly is a completely different person in the end of it. So it's very interesting.
And then, Asia, who's your character?
I'm a phantom. And that's just kind of like a backup singer and dancer.
And so what are the, I mean, I remember in the movie it's sort of wild and there's all sorts of special effects and so on. How are you handling that on stage?
Well, our costumes are really fun. The phantoms, we're half of a guy and half of a girl, so it's really fun. And like, we're using scaffolding to climb on, and the lights are really cool and the set's really nice. It's fun.
So all of this is happening it's the El Dorado Teen Players, and it's happening at the James A. Little Theater in Santa Fe at 1060 Cerrillos Road, and the James A. Little Theater is at the New Mexico School for the Deaf. If people want to find out more, they can call 466-4656, and the sneak preview is actually tonight at 7:30.
Yeah.
Yep. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Laurel Wilson, J.D. Bray Morris, and Asia Felsen are joining us. It's the Rocky Horror Show, and it's, as always, produced by Lisa Lincoln and the El Dorado Teen Players. For more information, you can go to eldoradochildrenstheater.org. Thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan says, if you like trombones, this is your show. All right, broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow, Robert Knott will be with us, and we'll also be talking about the African Effect Film Festival. So keep your radio dial tuned to 101.1 FM, KSFR, Santa Fe's only public radio station. Hasta la vista. Bye.